guys, and we, that's fine with everyone, we will proceed. And we will start with Jim Hughes. Jim, you want to...
Before we start with Jim Hughes, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, can I make a couple of remarks about two recent incidents we had over the course of over this week?
Please
first
do.
Was on June 25th and 26th, when Metro was affected by heavy rains and flooding that occurred throughout the region. Beginning on late Sunday night, we experienced high water at eight separate locations around the system. Staff was all out all night pumping water. By opening on Monday morning, all but three stations or three areas had been cleared up. The first was the blue line between Braddock Road and National Airport, which was reopened by 8:30 in the morning. The green and yellow lines between Galloway Place and L'Enfant Station, with Archive Station completely closed but reopened by 9:30. And finally, the blue and orange line was affected between Metro Center and Smithsonian, with Federal Triangle completely closed but reopened by 12:15. To supplement these services, free shuttle bus service was provided, and we used up to 76 buses at the peak of the period to help shuttle passengers around the flooded area. In addition, bus service was, throughout the region was affected by numerous street closures and traffic problems. I think it's important to point out that with a lot of effort from staff and frankly patience from our customers, we made it through the day. We did walk away with a number of lessons learned, though, and the primary one is that we need to continue to work on our passenger communications. We've made some reforms already to our e-alert system. We've even reformed the website so that the website has a much more prominent display that you can click on to get service interruptions. We'll continue to try to learn lessons from that incident so that we can make the next one even less impactful on our customers. I would also like to point out, though, the success of our work on the 4th of July. We had 450,000 riders. It was down a little bit from the year before, but it was one of it still was an average high 4th of July. We offered our special rail service with the Smithsonian Station closed. And even in the midst of all the normal difficulties we face on the 4th of July, we had the storm that came through, and our people helped work with the Park Service to clear the mall and shelter people. And we had a rail incident on the Yellow Line in which a Virginia power line fell on the Yellow Line. I want to point out, frankly, the quick thinking of the people who work here at Metro, from Metro Police, Transit Police, to rail folks, who actually work very quickly to restore service and deal with 100 customers who are stranded on the train. With that, I'd ask if Jim has any additional remarks to add to that and move right into the agenda, and I appreciate the committee giving me a few minutes to highlight that.
A few minutes while I get Polly and Dave up to do the first item.
Sure.
The flooding and the storms that we hit, if you know, around the regions were very dramatic. It was almost like a hurricane or a tornado in terms of what we had to deal with. As General Manager said, we had people out all night. We did have two of our three major tunnels downtown flooded that morning. We were through a lot of hard work, lucky to get it back up by around noontime. All the lines were running. As you know, many of the federal buildings around that area were flooded and closed for the entire week. Most of the Smithsonian, a lot of the federal buildings. So in some ways, we were tested again, as we normally are in a snowstorm or a hurricane. Our people stepped up. I think we did a pretty good job. As Dan mentioned, we always have lessons to learn. We could do a better job with our, particularly in terms of communication. 4th of July, we had over 2,000 employees out working that day. We had 800 rail cars. We had extra 170 buses out to help people back and forth. I think we did pretty good. In some ways, the storm did keep the crowd down, but it took us about an hour and a half to clear the mall in terms of crowds waiting in line to get on our platforms. I think we did pretty good. We're doing an after message with our staff to see what went well, and again to see what we can improve. So next year we hope to do a better job. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes.
With that, the first information is an update on our primary OCC, and Chief's going to do that one for us.
Chief Ansel.
Good morning. Well, speaking of flooding, that could very well have happened here at 600 Fifth Street. And if you recall, we've had two federal assessments done about our vulnerabilities, one by FTA after September 11th and one by the Department of Homeland Security in 2004. And the issue that was brought up, that our number one vulnerability is the fact that we do not have redundant ability in our OCC, either rail, bus, police or maintenance. And it's not just a terrorist event that we're concerned about, something like the flooding or even Tractor Man could impact the ability of employees to come into this building. And if we didn't have the ability to come into this building, our ability to run the railroad would be significantly impacted, and then bus and police certainly impacted. So the purpose for the conversation today is to point out, you know, there's 600 Fifth Street, and you look at close proximity within walking distance is icons and federal buildings that in and of themselves, because of our relationship with those buildings and because we're here in the core of the city, makes this building a target and highly vulnerable. So the issues that we're discussing are the need for a redundant OCC and where that redundant OCC should be. So, you know, obviously the OCC plays a critical role. You know, it allows us to manage some of the things that were discussed here. And, you know, when I'm talking about the evacuation of the train, the power outages, it's, you know, the nerve center of the authority. Next slide. Currently, if you've been downstairs and seen the OCC here in this building, you know, bus is far surpassed the space, and as they go on to have improvements to the bus, they don't have the room down there. You can see how cramped the rail is, and then, of course, on the left you have the police communications.
I can also add at that point, another key aspect of that last slide is the fact that you have to have three pictures to show these items. Really, in an ideal environment, the police, the rail, the bus, the maintenance would all be in one combined unit so that they could actually work together as a team without separation.
Well, and of course, that's what I was going to get to, was the advantages of shifting is the ability to have integrations of the key function. When we had the train stuck between Van Dorn and Franconia Springfield, our communications lieutenant, you know, runs next door. But when we have the opportunity to create a new OCC, he'll be on the floor there, as will other folks. So you will truly have an integration of bus and rail and police and maintenance so that you don't have that disassociated. And during the big events, it's really critical. But there would be tremendous service provided every day to our customers and to our operational employees to have everybody in one location. So what the suggestion here today and the information that I'm providing is that it's really the thought here that the backup OCC should be in this building and that the primary OCC should be at the alternative location. And by designating the alternate as the alternate site as the primary OCC, we're able to save a considerable amount of money. And my colleague, Mr. Couch, can talk precisely why that is, but our estimates are as much as $24 million, and it's on the cost of communications infrastructure. We won't have to replicate it at the alternative site, and we can move the existing infrastructure that's here, provide a hookup back to here, and that would be used as the backup. Thus far, 10.6 of FY03 to FY05 Department of Homeland Security funds have been dedicated to this project. There's $3.6 million of existing RRP funds for the phone and data, and then $15 million outstanding costs, which we hope to fund with the combination of the current UASI funds, and as recently as last week, Mr. Tanglerini was at a meeting with the CAOs and SPG, and there's a possibility that WMATA could receive as much as $4 million towards that project, and then we're still waiting for the transit security grants to come out, and that could happen as quickly as today. So the total cost breakdown is about 29.2. Once again, it's $15 million outstanding. But once again, we could get $4 million from UASI and then whatever we get from the transit security grants.
If I could jump in on that, too, that's about 10% of all the funds that are currently available to the region. The region has focused very highly on this project as one of the key accomplishable, meaningful projects that can be done. ESF 1, Emergency Support Function 1, which is transportation, has rated this the highest regional priority, making this investment So that's why we've been able to compete so well among all the different projects. There are over $300 million worth of projects in a pot that they thought was going to be $100 million, is more like $40 million. And the fact that we've been able to compete as well as we have really reflects the work of the chief and Mr. Couch, the whole staff, in making the clear case that this is a big priority.
So currently the activity at the alternate site is the renovation is in progress. You know, existing transit grants, as I said, the 03-05 money has gone towards the design, renovations to the building, power upgrades, purchase of radio consoles and perimeter security. The IRP funds are going to go towards the phone and data. And then the remaining $15 million will go towards the outfitting of the OCC, the ROCS related equipment, the PROTECT, which is the chemical sensing program, to the data flow, the LAN-WAN enhancements, public communications, and the transfer of radio infrastructure from the Jackson Graham. So that's the information item, is to several things. One, you know, we don't have redundant communication. That's a huge vulnerability. If we're going to have redundant communication, a redundant OCC, it really shouldn't be here. It shouldn't be in the core of the city. It shouldn't be in close proximity to things that we know are targets. The backup ought to be here, and the alternative or the primary should be at the alternative site.
Questions?
No, I'm just very excited to see it coming back.
Terrorists will never find it out there anyhow.
Mr. Kaufman.
Mr. Chairman, somewhat along the same lines as Charlie's comment, I know this has been in the works for some time, and obviously we've been predicated some of our movement on a steady flow of home security dollars. And since Omaha has now been listed as a terror site and our funds trimmed back, has the amount of dollars projected to be flowing our way significantly changed from the last time you let us know about the flow of dollars to make this happen?
Well, as recently as last week, it seems that WMATA is going to get $4 million. And, you know, I represent the law enforcement, the chiefs as well in the UNSC process. And I can tell you that the support for the WMATA project has been really overwhelming. Of course, you have the firefighters supporting that as well. And I think, you know, there are other ESFs that are very envious. This has been a clear priority. Certainly, the interim general manager's revised and renewed involvement representing WMATA has been greatly appreciated by the CAOs and the senior policy group. So I think that people are committed to that, and that was one of the projects that clearly you heard repeatedly that there was going to be funding. And quite honestly, there's only about $30+ million worth of money when everything's taken off the top, and to get four for a project, I think, is really huge. And then once again, we're waiting as soon as today, the transit security grants could be out, and we'll wait to see what type of funding we get from there as well. But Department of Homeland Security, what was then the Office for Domestic Preparedness, was the one that did our vulnerability assessment. And previously, they were the ones that gave the money out, so they certainly understand that if they've identified we have a vulnerability, that we're going to use those funds, and we need funds to work towards fixing that vulnerability.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that while the overall UASI numbers have been moved around and it's been a negative impact in the region, there has been some additional money put into the transit funding side. So there is the possibility those numbers will be a little higher this year. Our approach to this, and this is what we said to the region, is we will take as long to build this as we have resources available. And so if we spread it out, you know, if we can get as much of it as possible this year, you can do it this year. If we get half of it this year, we'll get halfway done, and we'll keep chipping away at it because it is our number one vulnerability. And it is our really, at one level, our number one security issue, making sure that the system has recoverability and sustainability in the event of any kind of incident, anything from a terrorist activity to a 200-year flood.
I'll just add one comment. I think that if you look at any of the transit systems around the country, and some who are a lot smaller than us have a much more robust, integrated operational control center. The ones that we have right now is very lacking. And the inability to have all of our operations in one location right now does create tremendous problems in terms of of communication, having everyone in that one room would greatly enhance that. You get a real, both big and small picture of your entire operations very comprehensively. And if you go to places like Houston, Philadelphia, many of the systems around the country, that's exactly what they have. So ours compared to theirs is a lot to be desired. So I have no questions. I think, you know, as quickly as we can move forward with the primary site and integrating all of our services, the better we will be serving our customers as well. The one thing I would ask another question, though, in terms of the our alternate or our backup redundant system, several times people approach me about the idea of co-locating with some of the other the counties, the others who have operational centers, and whether or not there will be any efficiencies and savings that we could actually have by, because it is a redundant system, it's not your primary system. The question is whether or not it needs to be as robust as your primary system. What do you need and to be able to guarantee continued operation over a period of time, and whether or not there are some advantages of having that alternate site somewhere else. And quite frankly, we still have the same vulnerabilities for an alternate site in this location, too. I mean, it's, you know, it's great to have the primary in one location, but an alternate is also on the target list if you look at where all of the primary facilities are within our nation. So have we any discussions or thought or in that area? Are there any issues there?
It's actually an effort region-wide to explore the possibility of being able to replicate the management systems in other people's control centers and turn individual entities' primary control centers into other entities' alternate control centers. And that's an overall regional effort that's being done.
I would want to respond to both of your comments, and Mr. Field will certainly agree with you about the integrated OCC, and I think he's mentioned many times to staff here that Philadelphia is the model that he's pushing for, appreciating what they're able to do there. I think Mr. Couch would agree with me that the problem that WMATA has about integrating our backup with somebody else is the heavy reliance on phone lines and the cost of bringing that into a center. And I'd allow, you know, Mr. Couch to expand on that further.
In addition to the phone lines, it goes to the connection to all the data, because you've got all the data flow from all the various train control rooms around the system that has to come back through our communications backbone. So if we do find an alternate location that could be shared with another locality, it really has to be in close proximity to one of our stations. Okay. That's really the controlling.
Well, I want you to elaborate on that. If you can just give me so I can at least have a response to that continuous inquiry, that would be helpful.
That is an issue that is being explored by the region, looking at ways that other control centers could serve as backups to each other as a way of avoiding having to buy multiple first control centers and then multiple backups.
Okay. Now, quorum, would you like to move on to information items?
Yes, we would. We'll stay with the information items, although we do have a quorum now.
The next information we have is on our car sharing program. And not at give that presentation,
please. Do we have the map on the screen? It's not critical, but.
Okay, you can start.
All right, thank you very much. I'm here to brief the committee on the status of the car sharing program and the contract renewal. Our car sharing contracts expire at the end of November, and we need to issue a new RFP to continue the service. Our intent is to request the full board for approval of this administrative item later this month, and I'd like to give you a little bit of background today on the program today and renewal. The program was implemented to increase travel options for WMATA's patrons in 2001, to increase transit ridership, provide mobility options, and to improve air quality. We initially approved a one-year contract with FlexCar with four renewal option years, and in 2004 we added Zipcar as a contractor with the same contract expiration November 2006. FlexCar and ZipCar receive spaces at different stations. Currently, spaces are provided in kiss and ride lots for shared use vehicles. They're available 24 hours a day to car sharing program members. We don't charge contractors for these spaces. And right now, there are 38 car sharing spaces at 29 stations with kiss and ride lots. There are presently 181 car sharing spaces near 34 stations that do not have kiss and ride lots. And for some perspective, right now there are about 2,200 kiss and ride spaces throughout the metro system that are metered for 4 to 7 hour use, and approximately 700 spaces that are metered for 12 hour use that are also kiss and rides. Let me just take a moment to explain this graphic, which is a graphic representation of the availability of car share spaces around the region. This is indicating car share availability at or near stations. So this is representing car share availability from the point of view of the patron, not from the point of view of kiss and ride spaces per se. A star designates a station that has flex car and zip car spaces at a kiss and ride lot or near it. And F designates where a flex car is located, and Z is for zip car. And you can see that we have some exclusive stations around towards the end of our lines. Current program status is our contractors have met or exceeded the requirements. The requirements are basically service-oriented, that they conduct surveys related to transit use. They provide timely notice related to new space requests. They posted required signage and so on, those kinds of requirements. The surveys show that since joining car sharing, about 14% of Zipcar members have sold their car, that about 15% are considering selling their car, and that 50% have delayed a car purchase. Since joining car sharing, 16% of Zipcar members say they have increased their use of Metro Rail. I assume this is a slightly different question. 70% of FlexCar users indicate that they have increased transit use. There's also reports of increased use of Metro Bus, and the increased use is up to 3 times per week. The program we intend to continue will be substantially the same as the one that we have right now. We do not contemplate charging for the spaces. We are contemplating an approach that involves competition for spaces. We are, and we imagine that we will be getting proposals from both FlexCar and ZipCar for use of spaces at our kiss and ride lots, and we intend to allow both of them to operate as spaces instead of having the exclusive framework that we have right now. There's no direct cost and no revenue associated with this contract. We do have some analysis that demonstrates increased revenue to the system through fare revenue, not necessarily through parking meter revenue, and that the fare revenue we receive from increased transit use exceeds the revenue that we would get from parking meters. So we think that there's a positive revenue impact, but it's not direct. The next steps for us are to obtain board approval in July. We intend to review proposals in October, issue a notice of award in November, and to begin the new contracts in December 2006 so we have continuity of service. That is the summary of our presentation, and happy to entertain questions.
Questions?
I have a couple of questions.
Mrs. Mack.
We don't assess the companies that use our property for their cars, right?
No, we don't.
And what is the thinking on that?
The thinking on that has been since the start that we were providing a service to patrons analogous to providing taxis access on our lots or providing loading zones on a city street to service vehicles. And that's a benefit to our transit patrons, and as I said, it's something that's generating fare revenue.
We don't charge for kiss and ride drop off. We don't charge for taxi drop off. We don't charge for other buses to drop off. This is really, in many ways, it's an extension of the mass transit service for those people who don't have access to additional mass transit.
I guess an additional point, I guess, about that is by allowing people to live in an urban setting without cars, it makes it easier to create a more transit-oriented environment. It allows and it reduces congestion on the streets by removing cars from the street. number of people who forego car ownership, I think, is a boon to a lot of the areas that we're serving with transit stations.
But we're going to collect more information on that?
That's correct.
Tell me about that process.
We will continue to require surveys of Zipcar and Flexcar patrons. We also are, I think, through our contract renewal, not foregoing collection of revenue from these companies in the future. We've heard reports that they're profitable. If you talk to them, they clarify the point they're profitable in operations. They're doing well enough, obviously, to attract new capital, but that doesn't necessarily mean at this point that they are profitable in the sense that, you know, Frito-Lay is profitable, something like that. By requesting proposals from both companies or all companies that are in the business, we think that we're going to get a much better idea of how competitive the landscape really is. We don't know whether both companies would bid, or, you know, it's Flexcar and Zipcar, and there may be others as well. So I say both, I mean
the
industry. Right. They may bid for every space that there is available, and there may be requests for access for more spaces than we currently provide. That would be a very clear indication that this is something that has market value to them. We're also, over the next year, and I think, believe you'll hear later, about a parking program update, we'll be looking at how we're treating fares, how we're treating parking revenues, and our intent is to issue a one-year contract with one renewable option year so that we're not memorializing a long-term free service provision contract in advance of a discussion that's going on. We just want to do something that continues the service, and we'll review the way we do this after we've made some decisions about how we're treating parking and how we're treating fares.
I think it's also useful to put it in perspective. We're talking about 38 spots right. out of 60,000.
Mm-hmm. And we are not exercising the option on our existing contract.
We've actually run out of options.
Oh,
there was an initial two-year contract with three renewal options, and all of those have been used.
My, how time flies.
Okay. When you're having fun.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Kaufman.
In looking at the breakout chart of the jurisdictional location of the various cars, I was curious of the 219 that are serving customers in our system, four are in Fairfax. I was just wondering, is that something market-driven? Is that a physical restriction? I mean, four.
It's a very small
number.
I'll tell you what I know. I'm not sure whether I'm going to answer the question. What I recall from speaking with the vendors and from the previous manager of the program, Metro, when this was initially put together, Flexcar was the initial contractor, and we specifically requested that service be provided at those sites. I've heard from the vendors that those sites are not profitable, but they've valued the relationship. They think that there's a good co-marketing benefit, and so they have gone ahead and provided service there, even though they state that those locations are not profitable. However, they've become less unprofitable over time. Clearly, their preference is for the center of the region for frequency of turns in the vehicles. If there's another aspect of the question or information I can get you.
I would ask that you make inquiry with the two providers whether there is, there's a significant market disincentive to having vehicles there, or if there are any other things at bar. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Mrs. Huggins.
Your response regarding the lack of cars out in those outer areas raised the question. Since we are not looking for revenue from this, that is direct revenue in terms of the contracts that we're letting, do we do any marketing since our purpose is to increase revenue by ridership? The inability to reach out and be convincing, for example, as the answer to having only four patients, what have we learned about why it doesn't work?
I'm just afraid I'm going to have to get back to you on that because I don't know the answer right now what our marketing consists of.
There is some, it's not us marketing so much as allowing them to market their services in our station. That we've allowed in the past banners and other posters. I think that there's been a question about whether this is something that the authority permits these organizations that we partner with them to do, or whether we actively push it or not. And I think that's a useful perspective to gain whether we should be actively encouraging people to combine a transit-based lifestyle with a car-sharing one.
It just seems if we advertise other alternatives as a means of inviting people to try Metro,
right.
This becomes really an alternative to the folks that are probably hardest to make the change, that there is an alternative that's viable and successful in terms of other locations. So, and yet, I know that means that it's revenue that we have to invest, but it also goes back to the other question. We can make our decisions probably better about whether or not we make it a revenue neutral piece in the future, so that we decide whether the contract goes forward by not generating revenue, but if it needs to generate revenue, there's a reason that we might want to, because we need to market it.
When we make the inquiries of the vendors about the market disincentive, we'll try to get a little bit more information on the differentiation between the use of the vehicles in the suburban settings versus the inner suburban, and try to get a sense of what those uses are for, and how, you know, whether there's an opportunity to market.
Well, I want to pursue it just a little bit, because I think we had this discussion the last time, and the reason being is that if you're in the suburban setting, whether you're coming from the core or going opposite direction, the first answer you get is, I use Metro, but I need a car occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
And it's most frequent in those areas that have not reached that full transit-oriented development, and they need a car occasionally. And it just seems like the marketing, a little marketing, you would be surprised how many people you present the idea to say, hadn't thought about car sharing, and what is it?
Actually, co-marketing it, and then maybe even building it into our trip planner, so you know if we couldn't get you there by bus at the end of the line, we could offer that as an alternative. I think those are great ideas. I would like to point out that one of the biggest number are the cars near the station number. That's 181, and those aren't Metro spaces. Those are spaces provided by the jurisdictions, and that's an interesting number. I think that the various jurisdictions have had, you know, either various levels of penetration by the companies themselves, or various levels of work with the company to provide spaces. So that's another point to make.
No further questions. We'd like to.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Zimmerman.
Just to clarify that number, when it says cars near station, that means cars that aren't on Metro property.
Correct.
But what defines is it?
I'm in a block.
Three or four blocks within the station.
Right.
Okay. So it doesn't include cars that are outside of that particular station area.
That's correct.
And how, this is from November of last year.
Right.
Yeah, because I mean, I guess that's really only significant in the district in Arlington. We do have some that are, I guess that's saying that we only have one that's connected. I guess because it's in the Kissimmee, the only ride in the county. But, so, I mean, because some of these are literally at the station. They're like, you walk out the escalator, and they're there on the street. But I'm assuming then that these count depending on city ones that are over by Pentagon Road?
I'm sorry, I don't know that detail.
I don't know if that's four or five blocks or not. I'm just trying to get an idea.
It also includes one right outside our building here. That's close to Judy Square. It's right on the corner. That's the closest place that it could be located, so that was near a station.
Okay. I mean, ours was basically a partnership with the two companies that, you know, provide spaces. I think the district did something similar. And that's one of the things that doesn't show here is the members, because that's one of the things we've seen a big advance in recently. It's just the
total membership. Total membership? Right, and that's, I believe that's about 20,000 members in the region right now.
Yeah, that's total, but it doesn't show where.
Right.
I suspect that having the direct program, you know, with the providers has had a lot to do, and certainly in our jurisdiction, boosting the participation in this. You know, we promoted membership and actually offered, you know, free membership and that kind of thing.
Arlington's
what gets people kind of, you know, hooked into it, being a part of the line.
Arlington's had the most aggressive program in the region, actually purchasing memberships for some. For some people, which is, you know, resulted in a very high use rate. When I was with the district, we modeled our program to the extent that we could after Arlington.
It's really a pretty small investment. I mean, it wasn't a half of a lot of money, but it really does seem to have really high payback in terms of actual increase in membership and usage of the program. Thank you.
Mr. Deegan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have FlexCar and ZipCar. Do we know of any other companies?
There are some car-sharing cooperatives that are geography-specific or nonprofit that are located in other parts of the country, but none that has the national scope that ZipCar and FlexCar that I'm aware of.
So we're basically just going to use these two?
Well, it'll be open, and if there's anyone out there that we don't know about, they'll.
And to get a ZipCar or FlexCar, you have to be a member?
That's right.
And what's that cost?
I think it's a $25 membership sign-up fee.
Thank you.
I'll just ask a couple of final questions so we can move on, because we have a long day today, so we're going to try to get through a number of items. One of the questions that was asked, one time we were talking about redeploying our allocation of cars within our own entity, and I think at the time I had asked the then CFO whether or not we had ever looked at utilizing FlexCar or ZipCar as a way of also reducing our fleet size. I think at the time I was told there was analysis done and wasn't quite sure whether or not it was cost effective. I don't know if we've done anything recently to examine that.
Actually,
see if we can, there are opportunities to further reduce the standing fleet that we have.
Actually, the current CFO is undertaking a fleet analysis, and one of the items in the fleet analysis will be asking the question, given the fact that there are 219 Flex and Zip cars within our immediate transit area, whether we can use those to help supplement or replace some of our existing vehicles. So that question is being asked again.
And we are including in the RFP an optional element for proposals on fleet management. So
okay.
It's an RFI.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. We look forward to hearing more about this in the future.
Very much.
Mr. Stoner?
Good morning. I know we're running a little short on time already, so I'm going to try to get through this quickly. First of all, the first slide here, I'm not going to elaborate too much on.
Guess not.
Slide up here.
How much?
Good reason.
It's just a list of
black cat eating licorice.
Yeah. It's just a list of some policy criteria items that we kind of try to define the program around, and some operational concepts to address those policy criteria. First of all, I'd like to report that the park program has been doing well, and I feel has been very effective in collecting revenues. Some of the things that I'm going to talk about today kind of address some of the things as a result of going to the Smart Trip Only parking platform has created some customer and reoccurring customer complaints. So our focus here is to address those customer complaints and also talk about, you know, our assessment of this program. Go to the next slide. Two things I'm going to focus on that are parts of this major procurement for parking services that I'm going to elaborate on a little later are two things that we're doing now, one of which we've already had board approval through the budget process to provide a short-term credit card parking platform in 78 lanes in our system. This is a discussion here, a conceptual discussion. This is an artistic rendering of what that may look like out in the field, credit card parking. Is to do a longer-term solution and bring up a concept to do debit and credit payments, maybe future use of contactless bank cards, give us the ability to change, to charge variable rates, have a different fee structure, similar to what other industry parking operations offer. we could charge a multi-day rate, things like that. Also, different payment solutions. When we get into our joint developments, where we're now starting to have facilities that are mixed use, where we're sharing that facility with other commercial developers, you know, a solution for that also. And that's one of the items that we hope to bring forward to the board later, is this long-term solution. Another highlight of this comprehensive parking services procurement that I'm going to speak of is improved meter facility operation. One of the things we'd like to do is convert our existing meters, our conventional meters on the right, to more a master meter system. There's a lot of benefits to this new technology. Master meters offer no need to hardwire the apparatus. You get on real-time data information. You have improved collection and maintenance processes in that. You can also, of course, collect debit and credit payment through those machines. And there are also cell phone capabilities. One of the things that's very good about this is a lot of our meters are short-term and are for discretionary travelers in our system. And if you get downtown and your meter's running low, we could conceivably have the capacity to have someone dial up on their cell phone and load more time onto their metered space in the system. And that's something we're also looking for. These items and several others kind of dovetail into this program that we want to bring forward to the board in September. Really, this is a concept where we would not renew the option year of our existing contract, our option year three of our existing contract. And in fiscal year 08, attempt to award a contract for a comprehensive parking services package. Basically, what this would be is a base package of the existing attendant services that we offer, and then these six other option items. And these option items would be awarded, they would be priced out, but awarded based on budget committee approval and board approval, based on programming or finding a funding source. Fund them, because the base is funded it will be funded, but we still have to determine the funding sources for these others. And these items are cleaning, sweeping, provision of these multi-space meters, that would be providing them, repairing them, collecting them, doing all the services. Preventive maintenance, when I mean preventive maintenance, I mean repair to deck joints, wash downs, things like that a parking provider provides. A long-term payment solution, which I spoke of earlier, a program to reduce the staffing in our parking lots. I don't think that you can ever get rid of all the staffing in our parking lots, because they do perform that human element services that we do need, but I think we can reduce the staffing. And part of this proposal would be proposers to propose programs that would reduce the staffing in the base program, whether it's through communications, devices in the system, or any other equipment that's available in the industry. The last one is a carpooling and ride-sharing programs, the development of those and the management of those within this contract, to come up with creative ideas to increase and incentivize car sharing and ride-sharing, whether it be through equipment and or the use of some kind of fee structure, reduced fee structure, or whatever. The next steps for this program is for us to, we'd like to initiate an award parking service contract in September. We're going to come back to the board in September with that program and more details on that program. This would be to commence in fiscal year 08. The last part of this is meeting with our jurisdictional partners to discuss funding strategies to fund these other six elements of this bigger contract that I spoke about today, and the third part of this is to develop those funding strategies through our budget process and to come back to board with those funding strategies. I think Chuck's folks will talk and elaborate on that, and maybe this meeting and future meetings how we may go about start those discussions on doing things. And so that's my presentation. Are there any questions?
Mr. Deegan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ray, I'm very excited about being able to use alternative payment. As you know, I've witnessed customers that are coming in, particularly at Greenbelt, having difficulty with the smart park your car. But I didn't hear you mention something that I think is the greatest technology in the world. It's called Easy Pass. Is there a way to include Easy Pass in our parking operation?
Well, there is a way, but we have had some discussion about Easy Pass. Their Easy Pass is a proprietary system that it's not easy to develop, and the per lane cost in our systems are exorbitant right now. We don't have the volume in our parking lanes to do that right now. That's really set up for something where there's tens of thousands of cars going through an individual lane. We have looked into that. We will continue to look into the possibility of doing that. One of the other issues that we have is Easy Pass system in this region. It really has two regional providers, one in Virginia, one in Maryland. So they don't talk to one another right now in the regional clearinghouse, and that's another hurdle that we'd have to get across. We are in discussions about that, but we have not finalized anything.
We did have a series of conversations about that because it struck us as, you know, if you're in your car, you probably have, you know,
Easy Pass worked from Florida to Maine.
It does.
Installed.
But it's interesting is the way it's cleared, the way they go back and pay back the transaction. And it turns out in the parking area in particular, there is some disconnect. They haven't quite bolted it all together. Virginia is a little different, their Easy Pass clearing from the Maryland Easy Pass clearing. And having something that would work within our compact area would be a bit complex. That doesn't mean we're not exploring it. We did talk about maybe a pilot in one of the two states. The question is how much would it cost and what would be the utility. So I think that there may be a little more time we have to put between now and when we get Easy Pass installed, but that's the exact kind of direction we should be heading to try to find multiple ways for people to pay.
It just seems like a very easy. That's why it's easy, right?
Yeah, right.
Call Easy Pass, you know. Whether I'm going to North Carolina or over to Fairfax, you know, I can use their toll road. Works well. One other thing, when we put this contract in, are we going to look at our permit parking as part of that?
Well, part of this contract is to look at processing the permit parking. We're also having discussion with our jurisdictional partner about the reserve parking program.
Is there a way to go to like a market-based parking?
That is one of the options that we're looking at, yes.
Because, you know, there's a great deal of revenue that's kind of sitting out there untapped in the parking lot. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Zimmer.
On the question of the parking, do we have any information? I'm guessing we don't yet, but would we do some kind of market research or survey to determine, for instance, what's the overlap between our parking customers and Easy Pass, as opposed to, say, the overlap with Smart Trip?
Right now, the Smart Trip overlap is 100%.
What I meant was otherwise.
Right. No, but that's, I mean, and that's the problem. That's one of the biggest complaints about our customers and our station managers is that they're forced to get 100% overlap. Going to the Visa, MasterCard, or bank card, we know we would get as close to 100% penetration as possible.
Okay, but you didn't ask my question, and I don't necessarily expect you to know now.
Right.
It would be useful to know what percentage of parkers would have the Smart Trip card anyway. And I don't know what the level of complaint is, but I know that most of us tend to react. We could hear five complaints, it's a big deal. But there might be 10,000 customers.
Right.
So, you know, that's one of the things. I mean, Easy Pass, and I'm a proud holder of an Easy Pass, actually issued by Maryland, because Virginia is one of the more recent additions, and I got mine from the Maryland Department of Transportation. It wasn't available in Virginia. And just used it this past weekend. If you can do something about Ohio, Mr. Ohio Turnpike is still back in that 20th century, but on the East Coast, it's certainly a great thing. But I just wondered to what degree, you know, it is in fact useful, you know, it would be useful for people.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd have to pull the thing out of my glove compartment and take it out of, the, you know, that protective bag, and I could do that, but I could also pull my Smart Trip card out of my wallet, and that's probably easier.
Or your bank card.
Take it out of my wallet.
Right.
Or what?
Or your bank card. And that's our point was it seemed to be the easiest, quickest way to open up the most convenience would be on the bank card front.
But to get back to the thing, I'm still not sure I understand why it is those who hardship to have a Smart Trip card for our parking lot. I don't understand what the nature of that hardship is.
The issue is not for the continual rider, the normal rider. The issue is for our occasional rider. And no matter how many signs we put out there, it's one sign too few. And people will go they'll come to the end of the day, they'll go to pay, and they'll realize that they don't have what they need to pay.
It's exactly that situation, and people not realizing what they need to pay. Of course, Easy Pass wouldn't help that either. So
right.
You're saying credit card because pretty much everybody's going to have a credit card.
Yes, yeah. And what we would do is we'd reduce it to the universe of people who don't either have a Smart Trip or a credit card, and that's not a very big universe. So we could probably handle that. That's probably 5 complaints.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Mr. Kaufman.
I very much appreciate the general manager and staff taking the time to look at this broadly. Of course, alarm bells always go off in the outer suburbs when we go into this. One of the things, of course, our parking program is one of the few pieces of our system that basically pays for itself. So as we look at this, I think we need to look at this as more of a well baby check than something requiring emergency surgery. I'd also note that of the, I think, 61,000 parking spots we have, all but 2,000 of those are in the suburbs. So this really is an issue for those of us in Fairfax, Montgomery, and Prince George's. One of the things that does stand out for me is, you know, this idea of untapped revenue. I think if I spoke to anybody pulling out of a garage in Vienna, they'd probably say they're not only been tapped, they've been thumped. Because this is the first step of a commute for most of the suburban. This is not the total cost. You're not pulling into a downtown garage. You're pulling into a metro garage, then paying for the metro fare, then coming in. And I've always found it amazing that we have bus transfers, but we don't have parking transfers. So we've obviously tried to promote certain aspects of the ride and not others. The one area there we seem to have put a lot of focus in this initial proposal is on the metered parking and this, and also better use of these structures. I can tell you that Huntington is an example. I know a lot about that because we recently looked at how we might come to the aid of the folks who had some flooding in the Huntington area. And I wanted to take a moment to commend staff for being ready to respond, and it ended up we didn't have to. But I found that the 1,287 parking spots we have there are 102% used. So we do have demand. I also am a meter user in Huntington. And I would just caution that as we look at going from, say, 7 to 12, given the proximity of the meters to the station, folks are going to probably fill those meters first before they go to the other because you get a lot shorter walk. I'd also ask that we look at how we handle parking for our customers with disabilities, because I often find the meter spaces filled with folks with disabilities, some putting change in, some not. So we need a policy there. Also, all too frequently, I'll find a folded-up Metro vest stuffed underneath the windshield, and the Metro employees left their car and meter and walked away from it. So we need to address that. I'm speaking now as a person who also likes the idea. We were talking, Gladys and I, about the call up, the extension on the meter, because so far I've shelled out two $40 tickets. I would welcome it. The other key question is we look, and as I see this as something as a precursor to discussions for our FY08 budget, you know, recognizing that, you know, this is a total part of our revenue picture for operations here at Metro. And certainly when the day is done, I don't want to see us, you know, increasing the cost of parking but not increasing the cost of anything else. So we need to keep that in mind. And finally, sort of as a philosophy as we go forward, I notice this idea of earmarking revenue sources to fund assets and service improvements in our system. I think that's a great thing. And you know, we've drilled down a lot here on parking, but there may be other areas where earmarking revenue sources to fund assets and service improvements might be a real positive step, because folks are more likely to, you know, open up their minds and, if necessary, their wallets when they see a real improvement tied to that additional outlay, something that somehow makes their commute easier, cleaner, safer. So again, I appreciate the analysis, but I do want to, you know, as I told Gladys, the quake happened along the same fault line as usual when I first started reading this, and we'll need to keep that in mind as this gets, you know, folded into the 08 discussion.
May I point out that it was really in the parking area that we first focused as an authority connecting revenues with a specific outcome. $13 million, the $51 million we collect, goes to defease bonds for the construction of parking garages. So in that sense, the construction side has been, to some extent, self-funded. We followed that up with our customer service initiatives that are paid for out of advertising revenue. The question is then for us on this issue of the well baby, how do we keep it well? How do we make sure it grows old without some of the health problems, we'll say, that our system has faced, making sure that we have a continuous maintenance cycle on these facilities. And that's one of the things that we found is not, we don't have a comprehensive continuous maintenance cycle, which means that we could be depreciating this this investment, this capital, as much as, much quicker than,
we might not.
Much quicker than we should be.
I would also just say, you know, as we look at parking going to defray parking structures, you know, I've never seen anything in bus fares to defray bus garages. So we can see I have all kinds of ties.
If I would say to the members of the committee, we do have an action item we need to get done, and we're running pretty late here. And Mr. Grant, who has finally arrived, is reminding us that he has a meeting that we'd like to start as well. I will say this. I like this idea. It's comprehensive. But as Mr. Kaufman indicated, there's still a lot of questions to be asked and answered. So we still have a long ways to go. And, you know, part of it's really looking at what is the parking policy, not just the aspect of revenue. What are we trying to accomplish with our parking policy? And that also includes the thought about the Zipcar, FlexCar discussion. So all that needs to be rolled in to, and obviously the board, and particularly us from suburban jurisdictions, have major questions about how we look at that comprehensively. I like the fact that you've looked at this and rolled it into a discussion about the broader policy, but I think it might be a little more broader as well as we roll it. So I would suggest that board members, as Mr. Kaufman has indicated, if you have suggestions and things you'd like to submit to staff, as they continue to explore that, that you use your emails and things of that nature to do so, that we can keep those things moving forward. If we can conclude that, I'd like to bring our action item so we can quickly close out this meeting, since we do now have a quorum.
Mr. Crouch is going to do the action item on our smart trip only access files.
I want to start this by piggybacking on Mr. Deegan's earlier comments. This is the easy pass look at fare gates. The concept here is to create individual lines that accept Smart Trip only passes. That then lets us go ahead and provide a quicker throughput and, in essence, a higher capacity through those lanes. We're able to go ahead and allow 10 additional people to go through per minute based upon the cycle time. We can get from 22 to 32 people through those gates as opposed to the time it takes to process the conventional magnetic stripe. The pilot will start with three locations based on your approval. It would be at Anacostia, the regional entranceway, which currently has 91% utilization in peak period of Smart Trips, Vienna, which has 83% utilization, and a New Carrollton that has 78%. We anticipate taking a couple of months to get the software changes done, to get the area cordoned off and the sign made for over the top, get the appliques made for the gates, and then go ahead and start the program.
Mr. Chairman.
Questions?
I move approval.
Second.
Okay, call the question?
No, I didn't call the question.
All those in favor?
Mr. Chair.
Question?
No, I just moved.
Okay, move. Call the question.
Who's calling? Can we have some discussion?
Can we have a little discussion?
No, I just made the motion.
Okay, just made the motion.
That's all I did.
First, probably moved in second. You second.
I just have one question.
Well, I have a few.
Okay. Mr. Zimmerman. Mr. Zimmerman. Mr. Zimmerman.
Okay, well, was the demonstration, was the presentation completed?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have a table that shows the, and it's your reference here to the percentage of users of Smart Trip in some stations in particular? Do you have a table that shows what those are across the system or ranking them or something like that?
Yes, I do, but it's not on one of the slides, Mr. Zimmerman.
And you don't have it available for this meeting, does that mean?
No, I do not have copies down here with me.
Okay, can you give me an idea what that shows?
Is it some 70-80%?
The top 20 stations, which all have numbers that are over 75%, are Anacostia, the North, Branch Avenue, Oregon Boulevard, Largo Town Center, Landover, Vienna, Grosvenor.
Okay, those are the ones that have the highest percentage of smart users.
Yes, in the peak hour.
Okay. And those that have the lowest? And how different is it?
The bottom end of the spectrum goes to National Airport, Arlington Cemetery, Georgia Avenue, Pentworth, Gallery Place.
15%.
Yeah, you're 15% in the AM peak.
Wait, where?
At National Airport.
Okay, and now suppose so Georgia Avenue Pentworth, what's that?
Georgia Avenue Pentworth is 38%.
38%, still significant. Give me Pentagon City.
Again, city 64%.
Now, the premise seems to have been that the place you want these express lanes, which, by the way, I think is a great idea. Our transit advisory committee has been pushing for something like this in Arlington. The premise seems to have been that those would best go in the places that have the highest usage of Smart Trip. And that's not what I would have thought. What I would have thought is if I'm in a station in which most of the people are using Smart Trip anyway, then I'm not being slowed down very much because most people are using Smart Trip. If I'm in a station where there's a low percentage, then it's a different issue because now there's an awful lot of tourists and so on, you know, that I'm behind and I'm trying to get to work, which is the reason for this, right? This is basically so our regular customers who have to get to work, you know, can go on through because they don't use the system and aren't stuck behind people who are trying to figure out how to get through a fare gate. And I would have thought, for instance, a station like, just to give an example, Pentagon City, in which you have a very high percentage of regular users, commuters, 64% you told me, higher than I thought. But we also have a high number of people coming out of hotels and, you know, doing all that. That's the kind of station I would think would be the greatest reason to have this express line. Or maybe one like Georgia Avenue, for instance, or some of these other ones, where there's in fact a high degree of conflict between people who know how to use the system and those who are trying to figure it out and necessarily slowing things down. So I'm not sure and I'm not opposed to them going anywhere. I'm sure there's arguments for Vienna and all that. But it just seems counter to what I would have thought would be the real return to having some kind of express lane. I would have thought 50-50 would be the one that you'd have the most return for. But I'm not sure I understand, and tell me why I'm wrong.
I can't say that I would disagree with your analogy, Mr. Zimmerman. What we were looking for was a starting point. What we're hopeful for is that we're going to get 50% or more utilization of these lanes in the three stations that we start. We would hope to very soon after that start to branch out to other locations. And we can take the ones and look closer at the places like Pentagon City. One of the complications that you get into is the number of aisles that are available to do this. If you have got a smaller number of aisles or split aisles at some locations where you have got only two or three vendors on each side of a kiosk, two or three aisles each side of a kiosk. You can't limit those specifically, and we will need to go in and do probably another look and another pilot at places like over at Fishery Square, at the north entranceway, where the aisles are in fact split on each side. We tried to stay with ones that had not only a high utilization, but that also had more than eight gates, so that we don't limit too many gates. I don't have the information with me down here how many gates there are at Pentagon City, but I know that is also a split array where you've got it on both sides. So we'll have to look at the other ones we can take and add to this list if you would like, another place like Pentagon City, and do this as four locations for a demo in lieu of.
Again, I understand the issue with the number of gates, and I would think, I mean, we neither of us mentioned, but I assume volume would be a factor as well. One of the reasons I mentioned Pentagon City is it's a very high volume station. You know, and again, there might be others. It just seems to me that the place where it's most valuable is not where we have almost total coverage from SmartTrip, but where we actually have a real split between a bunch of people trying to use the system who don't have SmartTrip and a bunch of people who are. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good question, Mr. Zimmerman. It does raise some questions. Mr. Deegan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're going to call this SmartTrip Easy Pass, right?
Not if we don't get sued.
One thing I learned shortly after coming here is such things as hitchhikers. Is this going to increase the probability of hitchhikers with everybody using the SmartTrip card, or do we have a handle on that?
I'm not sure that I could answer that question right now, but I can get that information. I mean, with the gates and the quickness of the gates, I'm not sure which way that does affect it, but I'll check and find out.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Coffey?
Mr. Zimmerman does raise some very, I think, salient points with the idea. This is to try to showcase for folks who maybe don't have the smart cards yet to go ahead and get them, because they want to move as quickly as the other folks are. So I'm just wondering, since what we're doing is approving, more than anything else, approving a policy of going to these express lanes, the exact location of where they end up, I would be comfortable, for one, in letting staff decide, incorporating some of Mr. Zimmerman's comments, where best to place them. I don't think it's a do-or-die issue for the board exactly where they go. So as we move this forward to the board today, you know, I, for one, and I don't know where my colleagues are, would be supportive to just give staff the latitude, given some of the comments Mr. Zimmer and others have made, put them where you want to put them.
Can I ask that we may want to look at five and not three or something so that we can try out some other types of theories. Well, I want to make sure we don't limit ourselves.
Sure. Mr. Marcuse.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The only comment I want to make, Mr. Zimmerman, your comments were very well made. I also think that there's a balance of incentivizing more people that should use smart trips. And so sometimes putting them where hotels are, those people are not going to buy smart trips. But there's got to be an incredible expense that we're wasting every time people get those paper. So I would also say the balance of all these things and let the staff make the decision. But encouraging people that should be using a smart trip card and instead are also causing lines when they're buying cards regularly, they're updating their cards more regularly, having to have paper. I'm sure it's a maintenance problem. It just seems like a good fiscal policy to encourage more people. So I would encourage the staff to balance all of those, and sometimes you might place them in places that you might not think are most logical, but I'm sure that's a sound reason that you're doing.
When we get to the budget committee discussions, you will hear some conversations about the fact that we do need to incent people to move away from cash. We do need to try to reduce the amount of time, effort, energy, frankly, resources we put into counting money when we do have an incredible smart trip program, and that might be something that could be explored as part of fair policy in FY08.
I'd just like also to note that I think we would offer an incentive by us also looking, when we say staff go back, that we include, I hope that we have include our station managers. This is where you see the greatest impact of the lack of smart trip versus the paper, and they spend a lot of time doing that. It would be interesting what they think the priorities are. Have you had that feedback?
That's a great idea.
So we have a motion that's been approved and seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Ayes have it, the motion passes, and thank you very much. If I would ask, we have one more action item. I would ask if, I mean, one more information item. I would ask if we could hold that over to the next meeting, if possible.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question about that. I assume that holding it over doesn't affect any operational.
No, this is just to provide information about the current program on the rail car rehabilitation. Just let the board know that we continue to work with our contractor, that we've developed some schedules for the rehab cars, and give the board some sense of what the 6000 series, the new rail car delivery schedule, looks like at this point. The information has been provided. The background is there. If there are any questions, we'd be happy to entertain them through other means.
We didn't have a quorum earlier today. I would like to entertain a motion for approval of the minutes. Probably move and second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Minutes are approved as submitted. We'll adjourn the meeting, and we'll now move into our budget committee meeting.
Mr. Chairman. Just do it right away.